Commandant Kuzminski got the orders. There had been one too many incidents in Little USA, the section of Stalinville where the filthy American children ran in packs, where the bagman and garbage lady snarled at the red troops when they passed, where thousands of rat holes were crowded with hostile thieves and work resistors. Sometimes trucks would be ransacked, and shipments of foodstuffs, clothing, or even weapons would be carted off by the swarms of violent youths. And now, the final blow. An elite officer of the KGB brutally murdered by a bagman with an ice pick while carrying out his duties in Little USA. There had to be drastic action. Kuzminski assembled 30 men and armed them with flamethrowers and tanks. There would be no meetings with trusty civilians this time. Grim determination etched the faces of the tall, black-shirted extermination squad. Their face shields were pushed up over their cold, intense eyes. Stun batons hung from their belts. Laser electrode firing pistols in long, narrow holsters sat on the other hip. They wore acid-resistant jackets and pants. The scum of Little USA had started making sulfuric acid bombs from canisters of acid stolen from Russian supply trucks. Kuzminski sized up the 30-man force. He inspected the gauges of all the fuel tanks strapped to the black shirts' backs, full to capacity. The death squad snapped their shields down and single file smartly exited the supply station. Sally, a garbage lady, was picking through the rubble at the southern edge of the Little USA sector. Overhead, split and twisting radioactive clouds crawled along in a deep indigo sky of death. Though no one in the city even noticed, it was a date that once had made Americans jump and scream in joy. Independence Day, July 4th, AD 2089. In Little USA, everybody kept an eye on everyone else, but let each other be. Still, there were always fights for little treasures. It was survival. The first priority was to live, and Sally was a survivor. Sally looked up and saw them in the distance. It was the dreaded death squad, KGB soldiers in their midnight black uniforms with the red skulls on their sleeves. They marched like robots over the rolling hills of trash. They were coming with tubes on their backs. She fought through her childhood memories. Memories repressed, finally forgotten for good reason. Then she remembered.
Flamethrowers! Flamethrowers! They're here!
She began running, slipping, and stumbling. The children didn't know what was coming. They picked up rocks and began throwing them as the black shirts marched closer and closer. Their faceplates reflected the random rays of purple-tinged sunlight that reached down through the poison clouds. They came in four phalanxes. The children didn't know any better. The first flames shot nearly 100 feet out from five roaring, flame-throwing nozzles. Instantly, the closest children were aflame. Their deaths were quick. All the children Sally knew died as she watched from her hiding place in the ruins of a wrecked building. The black shirts didn't lose step as they continued over the steaming, eyeless bodies, avoiding the still brightly burning corpses. The streets were deserted. Kuzminski led the second unit down the main avenue of Little USA, a potholed dirt road about 40 feet wide. No one was in sight. No resistance. He spotted a hidden entrance, a partially opened cellar door, a way down into the tunnel system of the bag people beneath the streets. Wordlessly, he raised his hand. The unit stopped. He directed his men to the doorway and made a sign with his hands. Kuzminski turned to the sound. A horde of pipe-wielding adult men, their clothes ripped, their shoes falling off their filthy feet, came storming at the Reds. They came in fast. But the men kept coming even as they burned, diving onto the Red killers, igniting them. The screaming Russian troops, who were chosen by the sacrificial flames, ripped at their burning plastic helmets and their thick clothing. Kuzminski dropped back to the rear, As they retreated, sending up wall after wall of flame at the still advancing crowd of ghastly attackers, the fourth squad met them. Of the six men sent into one of the deep cellars, three had been lucky enough to get out. One was limping. One had his hands to his eyes, staggering until he fell. Another soldier stumbled along, grasping at his profusely bleeding shoulder, a small dagger still protruding from it.
We went in, but the children, they had accidents.
He fell forward, his eyes rolling up as a second knife stuck deep in his back, thrown some 40 feet from the cellar entrance. Kuzminski called a halt to the extermination, a planned careful withdrawal. Soon, it became a rout. Then it was only Kuzminski and his second-in-command, Lieutenant Lysenko. Then Lysenko was down. Kuzminski ripped his liquid fuel tank from his back and threw it down along with the flamethrower. He ran in a mad dash toward the fence that separated Little USA from the Stalinville Soviet Army sector. He was at the fence, and the Americans were far behind. He would make it. The axe had come out of nowhere. Sally's hands were holding the handle. The head of the commandant rolled backwards toward Little USA. Kuzminski got a rolling, topsy-turvy view of the sky and buildings and ground before blackness closed in. The head stopped upright, eyes opened, but no longer seeing. The Americans gathered around it. A young boy, burned on the leg and arm, his bubbling flesh peeking through the disintegrating material of his clothes, picked the head up and stuck it on a wooden spear. He walked over to the garbage piles and found the highest one. He put the head on top, slamming the spear into the moldering rot, and walked down. Other filthy American bag and garbage people gathered silently below, slipping out of the surrounding ruins. Sally, standing nearby with her still bloody axe, did a macabre dance, holding the weapon high over her head. One by one, the Americans joined the impromptu celebration around the garbage pile, as dead red eyes stared down at them uncomprehendingly. Later, a boy not older than five, his face a mess of scars and oozing sores, found the body of the death squad leader. He dipped his fingers in the still lightly bubbling blood that rose from the neck and used it to write, "Ted Roxon was here," on the brick wall that the corpse rested against. So ended July 4th, AD 2089. A good day for America, a bad day for the Red Occupiers. In Washington, President Zhabnov lay in his recliner in the Blue Room, trying and failing to relax. The events of the past few days seemed to confirm Kilov's ravings about a real threat of overthrow actually existing in America. Westfort had 4,000 bodies in it when the radiation cleared enough for Red troops to go in and check things out. Kilov had overridden his authority by the use of the neutron bombs. But the success of the action and valuable information that was uncovered would prevent a reprimand from either Zhabnov or Premier Vasily. Kilov had lucked out this time, the president had to admit. When the ruins had been thoroughly probed, it was discovered that Westfort was filled with quite advanced weaponry and industrial machinery. It was well equipped with both stolen and self-made tools. And most disconcertedly, several areas that contained their most important undertakings and records had been destroyed with bombs designed to go off in case of attack. And this was, Kilov conjectured, one of the smaller American cities. Zhabnov turned nervously on the blue velvet recliner. Perhaps he should speak to the premier about letting Kilov have his fun with a few dozen neutron bombs. The portraits of his predecessors in the presidential office stared down at him. His eye caught the picture of Abraham Lincoln, stern, penetrating, watching him from across the large carpeted room. What would Lincoln have done? Lincoln had a rebellious area to contend with. He had freed the slaves and sent in armies of blue-coated troops to stop the gray-uniformed slaveholders. Zhabnov let a little smile cross his thick face.
Mr. Lincoln, you have given me an idea. Thank you. Like you, I will free the slaves. Free them to fight for Russia. I will call in all my scientists and tell them to convert 500,000 of our work slaves into soldiers. American against American. as in your own time, Comrade Lincoln. What do you think of that?
He stood back, looking at Lincoln's stern face. The president didn't seem pleased. Zhabnov turned away and headed for his office. He would have to start right away on this brilliant plan. The meeting regarding Zhabnov's plan was 2 days later. The customary tour of the Rose Garden led by Zhabnov, with all the scientists, technicians, and military and KGB top hats, infuriated Kilov as a waste of time. But once inside the White House meeting room, they quickly got down to business. Zhabnov's top scientists displayed charts in front of the long conference table, charts that detailed the ever-growing research and experimentation results of the Mindbreaker machines.
As I had reported previously, West Fort has been destroyed. We found its location inside the mind of a captured free fighter, as they call themselves. That man, Preston, didn't survive the night, but we have made progress since then. Yurov?
Thank you. Over the last several months, experimental subjects have survived attempts to make them loyal to their Russian masters. 2 months ago, we had only achieved a 24% success rate. But now, American slaves can be programmed with simple, loving devotion to Mother Russia. Or dogs. Bananas. Anything. With a 47% success rate. The programming is permanent, as all memories of being an American are burned out of their cortex with the laser needle probes.
And we have made progress as well, Kilov. We have managed to not only induce devotion, but blind hatred as well. Georgina, come out.
A woman captive was paraded before the assembled chamber. A very attractive woman of about 30. She was told to turn slowly about. She was naked. Her full melon-shaped breasts with pointed nipples bounced slightly as she continued to turn. Her strong legs were tan and supple, meeting in a light blonde bush at the top of the thighs. It was unmistakable that she was one of the star-patterned American free women who had defied mental re-education by other means. Yet here she was, obeying every command of the scientist Melnitsky, who had programmed her. He asked her a few questions.
Who are you?
Georgina Zhukov, proud soldier of the Soviet occupation forces.
And what do you think of the American free fighters?
They should be strung up, butchered, fed to dogs!
What would you do to achieve this?
I would give my life for Mother Russia!
Thank you, Melnitsky.
The scientist practically blushed. He would get a promotion for this, surely. Then Kilov stood up. His cold, calculating look as he circled the naked woman brought a chill coursing up Zhabnov's spine. The man was so thin and gaunt, his face so pale, those eyes boring deep. Kilov's tight black uniform with a red death's head gleamed in the ceiling chandelier's many lights. He walked directly in front of the American female and stared at her from about 6 inches.
Would you kill the ultimate American? Would you kill Ted Roxon?
Never.
Green bile poured out of the woman's mouth.
Kilov! What was that about? Why have you disgraced these proceedings?
I have merely demonstrated, Mr. President, that the Mindbreaker has its limits at present. Limits that my staff of technicians will remedy. Your scientists are good, of course, Mr. President, but they haven't been able to totally submerge the will of these free Americans. This obsession they have with Ted Roxon permeates their very being. It requires a KGB approach. We have the resources and the equipment in Denver to go beyond this mere fascination with Mother Russia your scientists have so far accomplished. The test is whether or not these Americans can forget their superstitious belief in this Roxon. He is the key.
Zhabnov looked around the table, saw general acquiescence to Kilov's words, even from his own forces, and decided to seem gracious in his defeat.
Ah, Kilov, I see what you mean. By all means, I will instruct my staff to cooperate with the KGB in this matter.
Later, Zhabnov sat at his desk, almost gnawing his knuckles in anger. He would have to have the scientist that prepared the defective demonstration executed. It was a humiliating defeat.
They would all talk. He tapped his finger by the white phone. He really shouldn't execute his top scientist. He really shouldn't. But politics takes precedence over a man's utility. Order in the ranks must be preserved. People under Zhabnov must know what failure meant.
Yes, sir.
I want Melnitsky and his family arrested.
For what, sir?
Treason. I want them dead by morning.
Century City was low on meat. Several hunting expeditions were called together to go out to the wild country to the west and bring back deer, elk, even bear for the freezers of the butchering rooms. Roxen and the toughest woman in the civilian brigade didn't have to be in one of the hunting parties, but Rock loved the hunt, as did Rona. Besides, he needed some non-combat time, some R&R. He had fond memories of the wild, craggy land to the west of Century City from his survival trek at the age of 16 from Tremaine, Utah, the city he had lived in after the murder of his parents by a Red Death Squad. Tremaine had been destroyed like Westfort, only with poison gas. As a child, he'd had only the legend of Century City to go on when he began his solitary march without food or water, with just a rusting .45 pistol to find it. When he finally made it to the great hunting land of western Colorado, he came across a land almost frozen in time from before the bombs. He had gorged himself on fruits and berries, then used a round to bring down an elk that strolled to within 40 feet of him. Rona and Rock loaded up 8 pack hybrids with provisions and sacks to preserve and protect meat and set out along the forested west entrance to Century City. They had 2 30-30 Superscope rifles and boxes of ammunition, plus their standard sidearms and liberators, just in case. Rona rode ahead of Rock, joyous to be with a man she loved. Pines were abundant, and chipmunks darted about the feet of the horses, playing games of derring do. After several miles, the trail passed directly under a waterfall that protected a large ledge, which spray bounced off, giving the riders below a misty shower. Under the waterfall was a cave filled with Indian drawings, scratched into the dark rock with phosphorescent paints that depicted other hunters in other times, glowing reminders that the free fighters weren't the only survivors out here. There were the Indians. They came out of that wonderful dark chamber beneath the waterfall, cool and damp, and headed back into the brilliant sun. A hawk was circling slowly overhead. Perhaps some Indian was buried in the sky nearby. Perhaps it was just catching the winds, soaring on rising currents of cool mountain air. A century after the bombs dropped, the world was beginning to repair itself. Only now were mothers welcoming a new birth, not fearing the hideous, mutated things whose lives had to be cut short to silence their screaming cries upon entering the world. Roxen knew of such births from his childhood. He had seen the faces and bodies of these infants of the atomic age. His own brother had been one, and he had watched as his father lit the funeral pyre that cremated the two-headed, clawed corpse.
Rock, what's on your mind? Are you all right?
Oh, I'm fine. You know, it's about an hour before sunset, and we've been making good time. We should make shelter in those cliff overhangs just to the left of the trail.
I think that's a fabulous idea. That way, we can make love all the sooner.
Soon they were encamped and watching the green-tinted sunset. Their lips met, opened. Her lips were as soft as petals and full. Tenderly, he pulled down her blouse to expose her firm, upturned breasts and cream-colored areolas, a common mutation in this area. He cupped her smooth globes in his hands, then his fingers searched lower. She helped him, slithering nimbly out of her hiking pants. She pressed her hot nakedness against him, trembling. She reached down and grasped his hardness. She was ready. He rolled on top of her, spreading her strong, long legs. He probed her lightly with his hardness, and then sank in fully. Around them, the nightingales sang out their love song, and the glowbirds twittered and fluttered amber as the free fighters' lovemaking intensified.